Is there any way I could stay with him tonight?
Are you a family member?
I'm his lover.
You're listening to the Still Queer as Folk podcast. Each week we take down an episode of Showtime's Queer as Folk TV show to find out if it still holds up 17 years later. I'm Patrick Randall.
And I'm Matt Dominguez.
Thanks for listening to Still Queer as Folk. If you would please take a minute to click the subscribe button right now, you'll never miss hearing my voice every Wednesday.
You can also find us on Facebook at Still Queer as Folk, on Twitter at Still Queer AF, and we just started Instagram also at Still Queer AF.
This episode is called Sick, Sick, Sick. It's number 18 in season 2 of Queer as Folk.
It first aired in the U.S. on June 2nd, 2002.
It was directed by one of our favorites, Alex Chappell. He directed three really good episodes. The Ties That Bind, where Ted is shackled in Dale Wexler's dungeon and made into a
suck pig.
All together now. We also met Hank Cameron in that episode, who, as we know, was J.T. York on Degrassi. Ryan Cooley is the actor's name. Full Circle, the season finale of season 1 where Justin gets bashed, and the premiere of season 2, Home is Where the Ass Is. I'm saying all my favorite words here.
Home?
And also this season, he directed Love for Sale. This is his 5th of 8 episodes. Chances are that he's directed other television shows that you've seen, so check out his IMDb filmography.
Sick, Sick, Sick was written by executive producers Ron Cohen and Daniel Lipman, and the teleplay was written by the duo Matt Pykin and Michael Burns. Pykin and Burns wrote 5 episodes of Queer as Folk. They also co-produced 20 episodes of the show.
Here's a recap of Sick, Sick, Sick from Queer as Folk, the book.
Emmett fights to keep the money George left him. Fearing scandal, the Schickel family offers to settle and give Emmett $1 million. So long as he disavows his relationship with George, he refuses.
Ben collapses while teaching class, suffering a near-fatal reaction to his new meds.
Debbie makes peace with Ben in the hospital.
Justin runs into Ethan, the violinist he met on his birthday. When Brian continues to refuse Justin's romantic gestures, Justin finds himself in Ethan's arms.
Ooh. I have thoughts about Ethan and Justin.
Oh, I can't wait to see that because I rather enjoyed that part.
Me too.
Oh, you did?
Oh, yes.
Oh, that surprises me.
Really? Oh, yes. Wait until we get into it.
First, let's talk about Michael and Ben. I gave this one the A story, even though it had a little bit less screen time than Justin, Ethan, and Brian. I think this story was just a little more important, so I assigned it to the A slot. So we get started with Ben. He's cooking spicy food for Michael, complete with a Tibetan cookbook.
What's that?
Oh, it's momo. Tibetan for dumpling.
Oh, it's spicy.
Oh, come on, you sissy.
My Western Pennsylvania taste buds aren't used to Far Eastern cuisine.
Well, it is good for you. It makes you sweat. Gets all the toxins out.
Was there like some sort of ambient music happening in the background
too? There was.
I thought I was hearing like chimes or something.
This was like Ben Bruckner, Homebody.
How zaddy? Is that what it is now? He was home body, yaddy, yaddy. That's what he was.
Yeah. We get to see Ben do professor shit again, too. It's been a while since he was like a professor. So we saw him cook today, and we also got to see him do professorial things. And unfortunately, he collapsed in class.
Right. And I felt like between...
I don't know why I chuckled at that.
Between the way he was acting at dinner, then when he eventually collapses during the class, I realized that it's been 2 episodes since we were given the information that his viral load was up again. He's having a...
Oh, that's right. I forgot about that.
Exactly. I felt like until now, the fact that he was having an adverse reaction to the current cocktail sort of took a back seat now to just be reintroduced for, you know, the dramatic purposes of this episode.
There was something in the scene where he's in his, teaching theater, I guess you call it. The auditorium that he's teaching in.
The lecture hall.
Lecture hall. There we go. He collapses and 2 people said this thing that I hate. It's like whenever somebody falls ill, somebody comes up and says, somebody get a doctor.
It's like, why don't you be the one to run out and get...
It's not so much like, hey, you go do it. It's more like when you see somebody in trouble, you don't scream out, get a doctor. It's like, call 911 or get help.
Somebody get a doctor. Get a doctor.
Nobody ever, ever says, somebody get a doctor.
Maybe the fine arts building was right next to like the pre-med building. I don't know.
But that's
funny. That's interesting. I didn't think about the fact that he said get a doctor.
Is it like dial 911? It's bad writing, I think. It's just kind of cheap. It adds, or it's designed to add a level of seriousness to it. Like, whoa, he's bad. Get a doctor.
I feel like we would get that considering he collapsed.
Yeah,
he's in trouble.
So they haul him away, apparently.
Yes, he ends up in the hospital.
With acute pancreatitis brought on by antiretroviral HIV meds. That is actually still a thing. I looked this up, and pancreatitis can be a fatal condition. So I feel like Queer as Folk got this story right, and it seems sort of accurate. I think it's a little more rare now that HIV-positive people on antiretrovirals have acute pancreatitis, but it's still an area of concern. There was something, there's another line here that I just didn't care for, which was...
Is there any way I could stay with him tonight?
Are you a family member?
I'm his lover.
He said it like so sheepishly, almost like he was sort of embarrassed. I hate that term.
I think that's a dated term. I personally think it's a dated term. He could have easily said that I'm his boyfriend, I'm his partner, I'm something.
Lover.
But I didn't find it that he was, I didn't see it as him was embarrassed. I thought he was trying to navigate it because I was waiting on the hospital to throw him out in some way and saying like, well, because when he's asked, are you family? And I thought, oh, this is going to be used against him.
Right.
But the fact that the hospital is rather accommodating showed a very interesting evolution, especially considering what we saw in the first season when Mel took Gus to the hospital and the nurse was a real bitch.
Right.
Here, they're really comforting almost.
Yeah, they're accommodating. The doctor was going to find him a pillow and a blanket.
And make sure that he could stay the whole night. Yeah. So that was, I was like, oh, we are seeing progression, which is nice.
It was just the term lover. It's like some people.
The term lover, yes, does stick out like a sore thumb.
Some people can't handle the word moist.
Which I don't know why. I think it's hilarious.
I don't like the term lover. The gang rallies around to help Michael, and poor Emmett has nothing to do.
Okay, I'll make his meals.
Since when do you know how to cook?
We'll make meals.
Look, I'll just order the meals.
I'll look after the shop.
You don't know anything about comic books. I'm familiar with practically his entire inventory. I'll look after the store.
Okay, you know what? I will pack him a nice little overnight bag, some of his things, razor, toothpaste, change of undies.
Did it.
Then how about fabulous floral arrangements sent to Ben's room daily?
What the fuck does he want with floral arrangements? He's unconscious.
Okay, well, there must be something I can do.
Why did the writers need to portray Emmett as so useless? What purpose was that in either the Michael Ben arc or in the Emmett arc himself? It just seemed like filler. Like, let's make Emmett look useless. But why?
I would have bought it more if it was Michael was feeling useless.
That's much more at stake
for him. I didn't know if it was trying to be a commentary a little bit on what's going on in his story, but I don't think it was as useful unless it had been like Michael feeling useless.
Right, because Michael has a reason to. Emmett's not entirely useless. He can be helpful.
And he's still definitely coming up with ideas, I will say that.
Yeah, yeah. Ideas that other people did.
But everyone seemed to like beat him to the punch or said, oh, no, don't you worry about that.
Something else about this scene that I thought was a little strange was Michael didn't seem at all surprised to come home to have six people in his house.
Oh, I just found him sort of dazed because like, that moment when they all sort of swarm him and ask all these questions, like, is he okay? And it's just like, that's the kind of moment where you're like, you just say, get the hell away from me. I have one thing I need to do, which is get back to the hospital. And that is it. I don't have time for your questions. I just need to get out of here.
Well, and I guess it was Emmett's house too. So maybe Emmett let them in or invited them over. But it just seemed weird that he just walks in there and there's all these people there. It's like, if I did that, I'd be like, oh
right.
Hi. It's like they activated the phone tree.
Yeah.
I did like seeing Brian in his best friend mode. This is Brian 2.5. So we saw Brian 1.0 in season one, where he was somewhat feckless and devil may care. And season two, he becomes a little more attached, a little more open and vulnerable with his feelings. He and Justin are openly dating now. And we hadn't seen him and Michael do this like best friend shit in quite a while. So I like seeing that. And I labeled that Brian 2.5. But why was Michael so reluctant to let his friends help him out? So he gets home and he has like all of his closest friends, including the lesbians there. He did not want anybody to help him, which I thought was unusual.
And that's what I feel like the scene between him and Brian is about in the bedroom. He's like, I don't need anyone's hero. I don't.
Yo, why not?
Hey, there are times when people are just like, I need to, let me just take care of myself. Like, they don't want to be baby. They don't want to be coddled. They don't want people's pity or sympathy. They're just like, sometimes it's just, people are emotional creatures and irrational. So maybe in your perspective, it doesn't make sense for Michael in that moment. But then again, it plays to the whole, you know, when he can't even find the right shirt, he can't find his pants. Like, he's completely out of his mind. Brian is there to help Michael in each moment. Not where are my where are my black pants? They're in your hands.
This wasn't bad acting on Michael's part after only dating Ben for 6 months. So we've talked about that quite a bit, where time is accelerated in a lot of cases here.
Yes.
I did like that Brian rushed to Michael's aid right in the middle of that pitch.
I have to go.
What are you talking about? We have a meeting.
Reschedule it.
I have the entire board of Frawley's open fire in there. What am I supposed to do with them?
All right, thanks. Order the mistake.
We hadn't seen that before either. We hadn't really seen Michael and Brian rely on each other in a while. So this was some nice writing that called back to a lot of the BFF-ness that we used to see.
I really thought that scene between the two of them was great. Like, Brian could not care less about that pitch meeting. He didn't tell Gardner where he was going. He just said, by the mistake, I have to leave. And I love that he was able to just drop everything that he had to do in that moment and just get to Michael and just be there for him. And I thought Hal Sparks in particular was really great in that moment. That his whole emotional breakdown was a really nice.
Yeah, I looked at it. Really nice performance. He can act. He really can act.
And he was bringing this. He was bringing like that uncertainty, the fragility of someone in that moment. It was, I thought, really beautiful and really heartbreaking to watch.
All due to Brian 2.5 coming into play. So there was something interesting here. We found out that Michael sat with Brian for 3 days in the hospital after Justin was bashed.
The night Justin was bashed, and I called you, and you were about to get on a plane, and you came here, and you sat with me for 3 days waiting to see if he was going to live or die.
That's new information.
Yes, because all we knew is that he got off the plane and ran to...
We never heard that he was sat there for 3 days. So that adds an interesting dimension to Michael and Justin's relationship, because ostensibly, he's also there to be in support of Justin, not just Brian. To find this out in episode 18, you know, this is stuff that happened 19 episodes ago. Mm-hmm. So I thought that was a little unusual to drop in there. It was almost like it needed to be put in to add some gravity to what Michael was going through. Brian needed some good lines. So, hey, why not tell people that, oh, Michael's already done this once for Brian.
And when we get to the, when we discuss Justin, Brian, and Ethan, I'll go into further detail of how I feel it very much contradicts what's going on in that storyline.
Yeah. So Debbie is outraged that Michael didn't tell her about Ben.
I told him this would happen, didn't I? I told him.
Right again. Congratulations.
This was interesting because she never wanted any part of it. Now she was just outraged that nobody called and told her. Uncle Vic ended up telling her. And then she defaulted back into the, I told him this would happen.
And I love that Uncle Vic is the one who sort of gives her the tough love. It's like, oh, well, congratulations. You knew. Yeah. You knew this was going to happen. You think that's helpful to Michael in this situation right now? And I think it gives her a little bit of tough love that's really helpful.
I thought the conflicting and contradicting feelings coming from Debbie were unusual writing. She's outraged. And then that outrage turned more into a, I don't care.
Yes, there's... Again, I think the whole thing of how she feels about Ben and his status has always not quite settled with me. So I'm glad that we then get the scene where Debbie goes to the hospital.
With her big like pail of soup.
That's a lot of broth. That was like one of those old school coolers worth of.
Yeah. Have you ever smuggled food into a hospital for somebody?
I have not.
I have.
Oh, what'd you bring?
I shouldn't say.
Oh my.
It was a little bit of liquor. Wasn't so much food. Well, there was some food. There were some potato chips, some Pringles. Pringles and a little nip of vodka. It's just a taste.
Okay, so if I am ever in the hospital, I know what you'll bring.
Vodka and Pringles.
Wonderful.
Have you ever noticed that every hospital in Queer as Folk looks like it's a set from the 1980s?
Yeah,
these hospitals aren't up to date.
No.
I expect to see nurses come by with like the little like cardboard hat thing on.
Oh, the candy striper?
Yeah.
Oh, can we talk about that nurse exchange that Michael has?
Oh, yeah.
Woo!
Feisty.
Time for his medication.
Wait, can you come back a little later? He just fell asleep.
Sorry. Mr. Bruckner?
He needs his rest.
And I have my orders. He's supposed to take this.
What is it?
His HIV medication.
Wait, who prescribed it?
The doctor on call.
Well, the doctor who admitted him said he wanted him off all medication. This is what practically killed him.
Look, I don't take my orders from you, okay?
That's what you think. If you give him this, he'll die.
I'm getting a doctor.
Well, while you're at it, why don't you get a brain?
Yeah, she's like, I don't take orders from you. And I was like, listen, bitch.
Which is true.
It's very true that the nurse does not take orders from Michael. However, wouldn't have the admitting doctor have updated the chart to let the doctor on call know, please do not give him the HIV meds as he is trying to recover from the dosage?
Yeah, you know, that's interesting because for the longest time, I had no idea how hospitals work. And one of my friends has had a chronic condition that would put him into the hospital every now and again. So I started to notice that it's kind of disorganized. There's different, there's different doctors coming and going
right.
All the time. You know, like when you're healthy, you have your doctor and that person coordinates all your care. If you need to go to a specialist or if you need an x-ray or whatever, there's this one person that's coordinating all of it. When you're in the hospital, you kind of have somebody different every day, unless you have like something special, like you break your hip. Then you have like an orthopedic surgeon that is kind of the ringleader. I think in a lot of cases, they're really relying on the chart. And
yes, so if we're going to trust this attending physician that said, okay, I'm not going to have you do the drugs because, you know, the dosage was way off for you. And we know that was the cause of all of this.
Yeah, I mean, in hospitals these days, there's also doctors that can do rounds. They can just show up and do rounds.
Yeah.
And they're essentially peddling drugs to people. So I wish that this would have been captured a little bit better because it's still something that you see these days where it's all financially driven. It's like, oh, you broke a bone. All of a sudden there's like somebody coming in talking to your mother about osteoporosis. Oh, well, you broke a bone. You must have osteoporosis. Take this drug. It's all on TV now. And if you believe everything that you see on TV, you turn into a nervous wreck thinking that you have like all sorts of illness.
And I almost wish we had gotten that confrontation.
Yeah, doctor. Yeah, totally.
It's like she went out to tell the doctor and then it's sort of like.
Then it ended.
Yeah, we never heard from it again.
Right.
Guess it worked out.
He chased her away. Brian shows up. Oh, what else? That was a very big fragment that just kind of hung there.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was very pragmatic of Ben to tell Debbie that it's okay that she hated him.
Debbie, I'm really sorry for putting him through this. Maybe he should listen to you.
To me? What the fuck do I know? I'm just a controlling bitch who should have kept her big mouth shut.
You're his mother. You love him. You're trying to protect him.
He understood her position.
Yeah. It's like Ben the Buddhist. And when he goes into Buddha mode, he
is at peace.
Yeah.
He is zen with the world.
And I'm just saying, somebody give it to her. It's like, Debbie, you're acting like a cunt. You deserve to be called out.
Well, I feel like that's what Michael has been doing. But the fact that Ben is, maybe that helps the healing between the two of them and why she stays. And that I'm glad that you understand why I've been nervous.
Yeah.
Oh, don't get me wrong. It still pisses me off that she's acted the way she has. And it took Ben to be like, I get it.
Now let's have some soup that I brought you.
Yes.
Ben's like, I'm not hungry. You'll eat that fucking soup. Let me go warm
it
up.
Push it to the end. What is she going to warm it up in? Is she going to go to like the nurse's break room?
Yeah, right. Can I microwave this?
We'll be back with more Still Queer as Folk.
Follow us on Twitter at StillQueerAF. Justin comes back from snowboarding.
In Vermont.
To find Brian, business as usual, topping a trick.
He's, of course, fucking someone.
Nice blue lighting. It's a great bottom, too. That was a nice scene. I like that. I watched it a couple times.
I'm eye rolling because I got annoyed with Brian in this moment.
Because he was having sex?
And the fact that Justin comes back, he goes like, oh, you're back. While still, like, he is still pumping.
Well, what you want him to do? Like, take a breath?
It could have taken 5 minutes to say hello. But again, this gets into the sort of contradictions that I've noticed in this episode with the character of Brian. So, and you can tell this is finally getting to Justin.
I wish Brian would have said something like, want some? Climb aboard this bottom. It's all for you.
Well, we saw how he reacted to that hustler. He sort of was like, oh, look, another one.
I would definitely have banged that hustler, though.
I'm sure you would.
So guess who's back?
Daphne!
Yay! We have not seen her since episode 8 this season. That's 10 episodes
school.
Ago.
She's in school because she's on her way to biology.
Curiously, it was also an Alex Chappell episode that we last saw her in. Love for Sale.
I think Alex Chappell knows what a treasure she is. He's going to put her in an episode if it kills him.
According to IMDb, she never acted again after Queer as Folk.
Really?
Yeah.
That's a shame. I like her.
Poor Mikayla. Something occurred to me here is that even though Brian had to go to Chicago to save his job, why didn't he just join Justin late in Vermont instead of blowing off the whole trip?
Neither one of them wanted to have the conversation to explain that Brian's livelihood was on the line. That's why he couldn't go.
But he could go because Justin was gone for a week. So Brian was gone for...
what, 48 hours?
If that.
So
why couldn't he just fly directly to Vermont?
I think this is the problem that Justin is trying to explain to Daphne. Is that like that entire week, he didn't do anything. He didn't attempt to do that.
Last episode, we were talking about Brian 2.5, where he's more fully vested in his relationship with Justin. Remember when Justin invited him to snowboard for a weekend and Brian's like, let's go for a whole week, sunshine.
Right. And it was all to celebrate that he was going to be partner and all these great things are going to happen. So after he comes back from Chicago and makes partner like he said he would, it would have been great for him to show up.
Yeah, this just didn't track right with what we had seen before. So I don't know why that was there. I love seeing Brian at work, though. We have some good shots of him being advertising executive at the Vanguard office.
This is the most we've seen him work.
That's true. I think as ludicrous as some of these scenes are, I think they go a long way in really making the Brian character like wider. He's not seen as just a fuck machine. He's dressed in smart clothes. He's doing meaningful work.
He's stressed at work.
He's commanding the room at work. He's able to go nose to nose with the owner and chief partner of the agency. So I like seeing that wideness in Brian. I think that goes a long way to really let us see the character as a more fully formed person instead of just like a walking penis.
Yes. Like now that even though he's partner, it still feels like he has to answer to someone. And I feel like that pisses him off because it's someone who can like get him. Mm-hmm. You have to figure this out tomorrow. You're the miracle worker. Remember? Oh, that was great.
Yeah.
That just like, you could tell that stuck in Brian's craw.
What a coincidence that Justin and Daphne run into Ethan playing his fiddle on the street corner.
Oh, right?
So here's another gap in this writing. Daphne runs off to go to biology class. She says to Justin after he sees Ethan, I gotta go to biology. So Justin and Ethan attend the august Pittsburgh Academy of Fine Art. They also have a biology department that Daphne goes to.
Well, no, she's not in the same school.
But they were together on campus. Where was she running off to and what was she doing there? Why biology? Why couldn't it have been like creative writing?
Well, because maybe she's not a creative type.
Yeah, well, but we don't know and we don't care.
I know. She could have said, I got to go to class.
Exactly.
I hear what you're saying.
She had this inexplicable story about where she was going. She's that like, made
I got
no
my prereqs.
Yeah.
I got to go to biology and then I got to go to like English lit.
Maybe the biology school is like across the street.
Maybe. Mm-hmm. Well, I don't think Justin was actually going to class that day. I think maybe he was just meeting up.
Oh, no. I think he was, because whenever he's at art school, he always carries that gigantic portfolio with him to show that he is artist.
I am artist.
Student artist.
I love that Ethan says that because he needs the money. He made $80 playing on the street corner, which I thought was impressive.
Do you really think you should have that violin out in the cold?
Hell no. That extreme extreme temperature changes screws with a stringed instrument like nobody's business. That thing would be out of tune so badly. Unless, I mean, considering how he was playing, maybe he's really keeping those strings warm. But yes, exactly. Yes. The temperature would be affecting the instrument. But I love the fact that he makes a comment about like, maybe I should go be a go-go boy. And I thought at first that this was a slight dig at Justin, as if Ethan knew that he was a go-go boy.
Yeah, I don't think he did.
I know. But at first I thought like, was this supposed to be like a little wink? Like, oh, I saw you at Babylon or something.
Yeah.
But then I like, oh no, maybe I'm just reading too much into it.
I think the writing with Ethan is really good. And this is a multi-episode arc. So they put some thought into how to bring the Ethan character into the story.
Because they have to believably sell the fact that Justin would contemplate leaving Brian.
Well, he's written as the polar opposite of Brian. And it's done in a way, though, that doesn't whack us over the head with it.
That's not like so completely the opposite. Because I think Ethan definitely has an ego that could be akin to Brian.
Well, pretty quickly, we see Justin relating to the creative side of Ethan in almost a way that he doesn't to like the materialistic and sexual side mm-hmm. of Brian. And then all of a sudden, they have to go shag a couch from the street, which is something totally alien to Justin, who's accustomed to a little bit of the finer things in life and Brian's loft with Italian furniture.
I would have been 1,000% concerned about bed bugs.
Yeah, I thought that
picking
too.
Picking that disgusting thing off the street. No, thank you.
Justin did immediately start to kind of relate and empathize with Ethan's bohemian existence.
Yes, it's very starving artist.
Yeah.
You know, it's as you said, it's a side that Justin has not really seen.
And he's responding well to it. You know, he came from suburbia.
I got very into this budding romance between the two of them.
Ethan's got some good moves. I like that character.
Justin then returns to the loft and he's sorting through his artwork and Brian comes home. And this is something that just made Brian beyond annoying to me.
Was this the honey, I'm home?
Basically, moment. Yes. You're home late that moment.
Yeah.
We had, and so
did you miss me?
Brian is bitching about the new client he has. And Justin is literally having a conversation
with himself,
Like he's carrying the conversation for the two of them.
Who the fuck are you talking to?
No one.
And what's with the little voice? Are you planning to become a ventriloquist?
It's one way to hear what you want.
It went in for me. It went into this implausibility of how conceited Brian is. I was like, Brian would pick up right away that Justin is annoyed or perturbed that Brian has not really said anything about the trip yet. Until later. Like, I feel like it would have been something he picked up right away.
He pretty much downgraded from Brian 2.5 to like Brian 1.75.
Yes. There's like a gauge in the writer's room, I feel.
Yeah. Brian's temperature. And speaking of temperature, it got super hot when Alex Chappell directed this fuck scene between the two of them. Oh, my goodness. He had him up against that pillar and he's ripping his clothing off. There's a pretty obscure song that I happen to recognize. It was called the Best Things by Filter. Filter is probably best known for that song, Hey Man, Nice Shot, that you may hear at sporting events.
I didn't find it sexy at all.
Oh, I loved it. It was hot.
It was clinical.
I don't know. Justin was into it. He was panting. He
was into it because he was being inserted at that time. That's it. He was clearly hitting a pleasure center. But to me, I didn't see any pleasure in that scene.
Really?
Whatsoever. Nope.
Are we going to have to watch this again?
I have watched this twice. And both times I'm like, this does not look enjoyable.
Okay.
It looked like Brian fucked him to shut him up.
Let's watch this scene again real quick.
Okay.
Okay, I still think that scene was really, really well shot and hot, but you are totally right. Justin was not at all in the moment with that.
I actually thought it was...
It was a stunt double.
I thought it was actually really smart direction in that it felt like, oh, these are the sex scenes we're used to. You know, it felt like it was all shot in the same way with those quick edits and you know, it...
I was blinded by it.
It like looks like it, but I could tell it was off. And it's because Justin's just having this reaction of like, oh, of course we're going to just fuck. We're not going to talk about it. We're not going to engage in it.
Yeah, he definitely didn't have those looks that I thought he had. He looked very not present. Good eye, Matt. Damn.
But yeah, I mean, I'm glad that we were able to talk about how, like, that was Alex Chappell was being very smart. And how he was going to present that scene. Like, they're going to think I'm giving them what they want.
I fell for it.
Aha.
Uh-huh. After that, let's head over to the art fair. So Justin had this funny little dig at Daphne when she recognized Ethan.
That's the guy who was playing the violin.
Really?
You know, for an artist, you sure don't see very well.
There's just something about the curt tone that came back, like... Really?
Oh, you know what? I thought it was Justin trying to play dumb. And Daphne's like, really? You know exactly who that is. I know exactly what you're doing.
I almost think that Justin was trying to cover his interests somewhat.
Yes, that's what I thought it was.
This art fair was really what I think is a multi-episode tipping point. Justin gives Ethan a drawing. And then he drives a hard bargain that he should collect later.
Who's she? She's a friend from high school.
How much you want for this one?
300?
Million.
You said I was brilliant.
Then you're selling yourself short. Ask for five.
Five?
Sold.
It's yours. For a song.
You drive a hard bargain. Why don't you come over later and collect it?
And I like that little seduction. It was very clever. This is the moment when we see Justin go over the hill and we know that he's going to give this a shot. This was the moment.
That scene between the two of them at the art gallery, that was sexy.
Yes.
Oh, I was like, I can see what you're selling, Ethan, and I am ready to buy.
And it worked because they then move on to the Bohemian flat and have a wine and cheese picnic on the floor to die for.
I am just fanning myself thinking about it. Oh, so good.
I must admit that I was so inspired by these, because Justin did this twice. He did one with Ethan and he tried it with Brian. I tried it that night and it worked.
Yes!
No Daphne required. So there was a line here that was interesting.
I want to be with somebody who only wants to be with me. Who doesn't need to see other people. Or be in the scene every night.
That line came back again. The virgin used it on Justin.
Why don't you go to the clubs, the bars? You meet lots of guys there.
I don't want to meet a lot of guys. I want to meet just one I can be with. Just the two of us.
Justin said it to Michael in the last episode when talking about Brian.
I want a boyfriend who only wants to be with me. Who wants to stay home every once in a while.
Oh, that's good.
It's deep.
It is. Well, and I felt like in that, during that discussion when he said, I want to be able to be with someone who's not into the scene, someone who I can have a picnic on the floor with and tell things. I was like, oh my God. It's like, I think after that scene, I was like, I think I'm pregnant.
After that line from Ethan, I started to think that we can trace Justin being open to guys outside of Brian all the way back to the virgin that he fucked in episode 8.
I think that virgin unlocked something for
him. Yeah. When I thought about it, I started to really realize that, okay, there's some good writing here. I started to see for the first time that the writer's room actually broke the whole season thoughtfully, because this arc goes back 10 episodes. At the time, we were always thinking that there was a certain amount of disjointedness between all these episodes. Here it started to make sense. We started to be able to tie together these long, long, long running threads together. So that was neat. I like that.
That's where I feel like we're now understanding how Cohen and Lippman are spearheading everything, that they've like laid out the plot points as we want them. And now they're landing the connecting tissue that we needed for this season, which I think was something that was lacking in season one because they were, you know, figuring out their footing.
We have to describe poor sweet Justin's picnic on the floor of the loft. We find out that Brian doesn't eat fatter carbs after 7 p.m.
Oh, my God. Go fuck yourself, Brian. I'm sorry. He does not have that great a body.
He does have carbs after 7 p.m. because he's always drinking. There's carbs in that.
Exactly.
I think if you come home to your boyfriend laying out a picnic on the floor, though, you're kind of obligated to enjoy it or at least respect the effort that went into it, if that's not possible.
In particular, because right before this scene, that's where we had that scene between Michael and Brian. And Brian made it sound like because Michael was there for him when Justin was bashed for those 3 days, that maybe that was going to awaken Brian in some way. Be like, you know what? I've been acting kind of like a douche nozzle. Mm-hmm. Let me be comforted in the fact that I have the man I love. He doesn't say it, but
that was an episode. The man I love.
that is still with me, I should be grateful for that. And said no. He just completely dismisses Justin again.
Yeah, he's like, what the fuck are you doing?
Yeah, why are we eating on the floor? Why are you doing this? I need to go out. I had a shit day, so get dressed. I was like, you sound like an incredible dick. And not to the point where like, oh, you're just being like the anti-hero and we should all be like, think, oh, you're still like the sexy one we should all be into. No, you're just being an asshole.
Yeah, it was funny in its awkwardness. I just kept thinking the whole time, Brian 2.5 minus one, minus two, you know, you see,
dial keeps
exactly,
turning.
Exactly. The scene in the back room was hot though. This one I liked. There's another song here that I remembered by Basement Jacks. It's called Get Me Off when Brian's getting blown in there. There was all sorts of activity going on in that back room.
There was a lot.
It was really shot well, nice blocking. Mm-hmm. Like, okay, you'll be rimming, you'll be blowing, you'll be taking it, you'll be giving it. Now we want blue lights, action.
Right.
Everybody, fuck. Sound.
And when Brian, after he takes a hit of the trail mix or poppers or a combination of both, and someone starts to go down on him, we cut to one of the Leathermen that's in the back room. And he says,
eat the meat. Eat the meat.
One of the most ridiculous fucking lines I think I have heard in this series.
What? You didn't like Eat the Meat?
It's the way he said it.
Oh, I loved it.
First of all, I don't want anyone eating my dick.
Oh, talk dirty to me.
Eating that appendage is not sexy to me.
Oh, I love
you
this little thing.
You can suck it. You can jerk it. You can do all sorts of things. Don't eat it. I'm not interested in teeth.
Don't chew.
Exactly.
So. But I loved it because Brian has to come up with an ad campaign for a steakhouse. I thought this was clever as fuck.
I cackled so hard when it was said because I just thought it was utterly ridiculous.
Oh, I loved it.
But
I thought it was a great ad campaign.
The thing is, I think because Brian chuckled at it too, I became a little more okay with it. But I will admit, the first time I heard it, I just guffawed. I think that's the right way to say it.
Maybe I loved it so much because on ESPN, there's an Arby's commercial that always plays where it says,
Arby's, we have the meat.
And so it was close to eat the meat. And I just thought it was a great ad campaign the way you put it together. They just put eat the meat in red letters on a blackboard.
It's a very clever.
The Steakman thought it was great.
Yeah, because, and I thought that was smart to say, like, it was almost like a teaser.
Mm-hmm.
Eat the meat is the teaser. And then the second phase, you're going to get the full trailer.
Yeah.
And it's like, eat the meat. Okay. Mm. That's good. I also thought that those clients were like a Canadian's image of a Midwesterner. Just like, one of my favorite little things that Alex Chappell did was do a slight push in the main client. We said, there's something vaguely pushing sexual about that.
And he liked it. Brian liked it too. The young singles, eat the meat.
It just came to him or did it come upon him.
Oh, so Justin, after his failed picnic, goes over to the Bohemian Flat. That's what we'll call
Bohemian Flat?
Yeah, that's what we'll call Ethan's place.
Okay.
And he's just pounding endlessly on the door. So here's my problem with that. If you walk up to a guy that you're interested in, to his flat, and you hear him rehearsing, I would have sat in the hallway listening until he took a break. I wouldn't knock, pound, bang, kick until he came and let me in. I would let him have his moment. Let him practice. I would enjoy the free concert.
The thing is, I think Justin would have finished by the time Ethan was done.
Well,
it was gorgeous what he was playing.
There's a great moment of tension when he arrives and Justin says that he came for his song. And Chappell did two slow zooms onto Justin and Ethan as they're looking at each other. It really built up to this nice moment of anticipation. I really thought that they were going to just grab each other and make out. And I like that they didn't.
Oh, it's like it got real close.
Mm-hmm.
But then he played.
There was a nice set dressing moment here. I'm not sure if this is a set piece or if this is a prop because it was handled at one point, but then in this scene it was not handled. So I think it might become part of the set. But the drawing that Justin gave Ethan from the art fair was on Ethan's wall. It's great.
Oh my.
I love that moment.
Oh my.
Mm-hmm. So he requests something astonishingly romantic. And then it's like,
just fanning myself.
Mm.
The vapors.
So it worked because then there's the makeout scene that we've been waiting for. And for a moment I was like, Ethan, you homewrecker, you. He knew that Justin had a boyfriend. He was like, he was all in. He's going for it.
They're open. It doesn't matter.
Yeah, that song, though. Mm. Have you ever had somebody play music for you? Like in a one-on-one situation like that?
I have not.
Really? Not even after rehearsal at a theater and somebody from the band stays behind?
Never, never one-on-one. It's never been one-on-one.
You have the whole band play. The whole band serenades you.
There's always been other people in the room.
Mm.
So, yeah, no.
Let
me just say, major turn-on.
I've got a better one, I think. You might like this one. So
I'm out of wine already, so I can't even take a drink before this. Continue.
Several years ago, I was seeing this boy. He was a musician. He was in a band.
Of course they were.
Yeah. It's like, And he once woke me up playing acoustic guitar. He was playing Perfect by the Smashing Pumpkins.
Oh, my God.
And I was like, He was just sitting at the end of the bed, just in cute little undies, playing the song and singing it. And I was like melting at the time. And I remember, and this is the part that you're going to love. I was telling one of my other friends about it and just saying how wonderful he is and how thoughtful, blah, blah, blah. And my friend points out that the song Perfect is about breaking up.
Oh, son of a bitch.
And we didn't break up, but I don't know if he knew that. I don't know is that he really ever digested the lyrics of that song. But the song's about breaking up with somebody and leaving them behind and saying, yeah, we might have been, but we're not.
Oh, my God.
I know. I don't talk to that guy anymore. But recently, I ran into him on an app.
Oh, my.
He said hello. It's nice.
Oh.
He's adopted children.
Oh.
Yeah. I'm like, okay. And that's not where I'm going to be in life.
Nope. So,
perfect.
This is when you slowly back away into the shrubbery.
Mm-hmm. So this episode ends with Ethan and Justin hooking up as Love Song by The Cure plays.
Fan. I'm a fan.
That is a hugely expensive song. So I wanted to call out again, the same two music supervisors are still working on the show here. It was Michael Perlmutter and Scott McFadden. Great, great, great choice of music throughout this entire episode. And I haven't done this in a while, but I looked at the streaming version and it was just a hilariously awful song. Let's listen to both of them right now and compare. Still surprised that Showtime actually hired musicians to create a new soundtrack for the show instead of just securing synchronization licenses to the music that was already there, because quite a few songs are probably cheaper today than they were then, yet they hired people to do this. I can't believe that it was cheaper.
Absolute trash.
We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll talk about Emmett the Millionaire.
Like what you hear? Be sure to subscribe and rate us on iTunes. We like those 5 stars.
This is still Queer as Folk, and there's more to come. Stick around. So we also find out that Melanie practices estate law in addition to criminal, civil, family, and employment law.
Because she is lawyer.
Law. There's something that occurred to me here with this $10 million that Emmett suddenly came into possession of and the Schickel family trying to reclaim it. This was not an inheritance. It was a gift from George, who was living at the time. He gave that money to Emmett. He even made a video of himself while he was alive giving it to Emmett. So as a result, the Schickel family wouldn't be able to claw that back from him. It would be like me giving you $100 and then me stepping out of the studio and getting hit by a bus, and then my heirs saying, get us that $100 back.
The first note I had was, screw these lawyers. Because you have this tape that had been arranged to be given to Emmett. There's just a whole lot of plan and coordination that I feel like the Schickel family lawyers would have had a real hard time trying to prove that Emmett had somehow managed to orchestrate this entire thing.
But it didn't even matter because George gave him the money while he was alive.
While he was alive. It was in his will.
It was a gift. No, it wasn't in the will. He gave him the money.
Oh, you know, it's true because we didn't even see the discussion of the will. We didn't see any of that.
Yeah, this was not an inheritance. This was a gift before George died. So the Schickel family has no claim to this money. Melanie should have known that. She practices law.
But I do like her tactic, though, with the attorneys and saying, so they, when they meet with all of them and the lead attorney concocts this entire story of like, oh, this is what you did, though, isn't it? And being a real smarmy prick. And she goes like, you're right. I will never present this as evidence because I'm going to give it to the press.
You really believe a judge and jury will think otherwise once they view this?
I can't answer that since I don't plan on presenting it as court evidence. I intend to release it to the press so that people will see that Mr. Honeycutt is being denied the recognition and the legacy of a legitimate, loving relationship. But whatever the outcome, once the public takes a look at this, they'll never think of a Schickel's pickle in the same way again.
I thought it was funny that they had 5 lawyers taking on poor little Melanie.
Right. And they, and the fact that all of their faces changed as soon as she said the word press was priceless.
Yeah. Why do they need 5 lawyers though? That's like $400 an hour times 5. So that's $2,000 or $2K an hour that Virginia Hammond is paying. And they're like in an oak paneled room, which looks nothing like any law firm that I've ever been in.
It was all an intimidation tactic to say like, Emmett, see, this army of lawyers is what's going to come after you. I bet half of them weren't even actually lawyers.
Bring in the paralegal.
Exactly.
Bring in the Bob from the copy shop.
Show this as like an army front and he'll cave.
Well, I did have an appreciation for the Schickel family's position, even though it was wrong. Emmett didn't manipulate George into giving him the money, though. I think...
Well, we know this, but they don't want any type of press to say George was a homosexual, even though he was seen out in public.
The man is dead. Who cares?
And he died while fucking a dude on the plane. Like, that story didn't get out.
Yeah, exactly. What? So why does it matter? Why would the story getting out matter? And you can't have the money anyway. It's not an inheritance. Point of order. I thought the Emmett story is really sweet, though. He asks questions of kind of how far you'd go to protect an inheritance, because he went from having 10 million to 1 million, and he could only have the 1 million if he would disavow the entire relationship. So I like those existential questions that you'll probably never find yourself in.
Right. Because I appreciated Mel and Ted's position on it, of saying what matters is what George has meant to you. Who cares what other people think? Sure, but to deny that out loud and in writing, that's a tricky thing. Like, is that really worth $1 million?
Yeah, I like those existential questions. $10 million? Sold. $1 million? Let's think about it.
Right.
Because at the end of the day, I think it's really between you, your conscience, and whatever belief system you have about dead people.
And I think Emmett has been set up to be that kind of character who is pretty honorable.
Yeah.
And it's quite a beautiful thing. I think between all of the characters on this show, he's one of the most honorable people.
Yeah, he walked away from that $1 million, which...
Yes, he said, like, let me see that check. And he gave a speech and he tore it up. And he said, I'm going to hold on to that because that's worth more than anything. And that is the gift I give to George. And I feel like if this was in front of a live studio audience, this is what they would applaud and cheer.
Well, instead it's in front of anonymous lawyers. That scene needed to be in front of Virginia Hammond.
Get that bitch.
Yeah.
Get her.
So what's interesting here, though, is that Melanie kind of blew it as a lawyer. She didn't do any negotiation on the settlement. They went from $10 million to, like, here's $1 million. Just go away. Why didn't she say $5 million?
Her ace in the hole was the tape. So,
yeah, she rolled over right away, though.
Yeah, I think the idea was to get Emmett anything.
Yeah, I think she could have gotten more if she would have done more. She just kind of showed up. Her only contribution was threatening to release the tape, which...
It got him quite a bit of money, but yeah, you're right. It could have been like, really? $1 million?
She got 10%.
Yeah.
Come on, 10%. Melanie. You can do better. And what is more curious is that the Schickel family almost certainly controlled the copyright of that tape, so she couldn't have published it anyway.
And I want to know, is $10 million to the Schickel Hammond fortune really that much?
Yeah, good point.
Like, if $10 million would have said, like, all right, $10 million, I'll go away. Mm-hmm. Instead, they sort of stuck their nose in it more.
What do you think happened to all the gifts that Emmett gave, like Melanie's Subaru? Is Virginia Hammond driving it now?
Right. Maybe the conversation was like, listen, keep all... Because, yeah, he returns the coat.
Right.
So yeah, what happens to the bracelet? What happens to the trip to Italy? What happens to the Subaru? What happens to the
Armani Fall Collection?
What happens to the Lifetime seats at the opera? These are good questions.
Yeah. Melanie, you should have negotiated those in.
Right.
So, like, here's $1 million. Keep everything that you've already spent.
Right.
We're done.
Bye.
Or, you know, like, here's $5 million. Get like 50%. It's like, come on, Melanie. You can do it. You speak all access powers. Well, she did in one episode, and then she never spoke.
Then she didn't know French.
Again.
So
exactly. All right, let's recap this episode. Timeliness. I give this one a 4.
Oh.
Ben's HIV story is timeless. It still happens today. The other two stories were just middle of the road. Not offensive, not really contemporary, not really ancient history. So I give it a mark up to 4.
I give it a 3 because I didn't really find it offensive in any way. It was pretty, save for the drug holiday, which I think, as we've discussed, have been answered for me. I just, 3, nothing out of the ordinary, but nothing extraordinary either.
For information accuracy, I gave this one a rare 5.
Whoa.
I feel like Queer as Folk got Ben's HIV story fundamentally right. It's more rare these days to have those near-death situations, but it absolutely still happens, especially the older that you get. So I felt like they did their homework on this one, which was very refreshing.
I originally gave it a 3 because I was just going to go along with the whole drug holiday business. But based on what we've discussed, I'll bump it up to 4. And that I wasn't aware that drug holiday was apparently still a thing.
Structured treatment interruption.
Structured treatment interruptions now.
Wait, that stands for STI.
They've got to be careful with that now. But yeah, I'll bump it up to 4.
Relatability, I give this one a 4. Emmett's story was a little outlandish, which makes it hard to relate to, but a sick lover, as Michael called Ben, and boyfriends getting bored with each other is very relatable. So I thought this episode really, really did well across the board.
I gave it 4 as well. Seeing a relationship on the rocks really, I think, portrays showing that, like, clearly because Justin is younger. What stuck with me is a line that Justin and Brian share with each other when Brian tells Justin he's too old to settle, and Justin snaps right back with too old to fuck around.
Mm.
And I was like, oh, here's where we can also now see a bit of how the age difference plays into what they think about relationships. Because Ethan is clearly closer to Justin's age. And,
oh, yeah.
And definitely closer to being on that same kind of emotional track than as Justin. So yeah, bump it up to 4.
So that's our verdict on season 2, episode 18, Sick, Sick, Sick.
Next week, Michael discovers Justin's affair and is tempted to tell Brian.
Mel and Lindsay feel awkward with Lita around.
Debbie challenges Carl to a bowling contest.
Bowling?
With the Liberty Balls.
Oh, that's right. That will be episode 19 of season 2. And it's called Bowling for Equality. I think there's only one episode left after that one for this season. We are still Queer as Folk. Please rate and or review us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to us. And subscribe. It really means a lot to us. It really, really does. And it helps more people find our show.
We're on Twitter and Instagram at StillQueerAF, and you can find us on Facebook at StillQueerAsFolk.
If you want to connect with us personally, and I hope you do, you can find me on Instagram at Patrick Randall, no E's.
You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at MatthewPD with 2 T's.
Thanks for joining us. I'm Patrick Randall.
And I'm Matt Dominguez.
We'll see you next week. Still, Queer as Folk was written and performed by Patrick Randall and Matt Dominguez.
New episodes every Wednesday as we take apart the show one episode at a time.
Available now on iTunes,
Google Play,
Stitcher,
TuneIn,
Overcast,
Pocket Cast, and all your other favorite podcatchers.
Still, Queer as Folk is made with love in Chicago.